should trust it. Our last mega conference in 2014 had Paul and Stephen with us, and it was great having them on. Pleased to have them back. They take a stance of authority for us, so we're happy to have them back again with us. And as you can see, Paul is our smartest speaker so far. Professor Andy McIntosh is wearing a tie. Paul's wearing a tie. I made the mistake. Anyway, Paul's going to speak on geological evidence against the millions of years time scale. And I'm going to let Paul tell you a bit about what Biblical Creation Trust does, because he knows better than I do. So with that, I'm going to hand over to Paul.
Well, thank you very much for that, Simon. Thank you for your welcome. What a phenomenal conference. It's terrific to see so many people joining us here this week to hear these talks on origins. And it's great to be here. We're very grateful to our friends in Answers in Genesis for organising this conference and for inviting those of us in Biblical Creation Trust to take part. We're very pleased to be here. Before we get into the substance of the talk, I would just like to say a word or two about the work of Biblical Creation Trust. Biblical Creation Trust is a small gospel organisation that works in partnership with local churches, both here in the UK and also overseas, helping the church to respond to contemporary challenges concerning origins in a theologically and scientifically robust way. If you visit our stand, which is in the Henman D room, you can pick up one of our introductory leaflets that looks like this, Introducing Biblical Creation Trust. It will just tell you a little bit more about who we are. I have worked full-time for the organisation for, I think, close to 15 years now. My background is in geology, and specifically my master's focusing on paleobiology. My colleague, Dr. Stephen Lloyd, it works for us part-time, and also part-time as a church pastor in Gravesend in Kent. He has a science background, did his PhD in materials science at Cambridge, and also has a diploma in theology. There are three strands to our ministry: theological, scientific, and apologetics. And you can read about those in our leaflet. We do lots of speaking and media around the country. We get involved in scientific research. Those of you who were here at the last mega conference may remember the talk I gave on the research we did on the Coconino sandstone with colleagues in America. We produce publications. Many of you will know this book, The New Creationism, a book that was published, written by me, published by Evangelical Press in 2009. And we have a particular strategic focus on trying to reach students and church leaders in training, those will be church leaders in the future, and also current church leaders. And we produce some resources for students, including this little booklet, which is available on our stand. This is 50p. It's called I'm a Creationist, Get Me Out of Here. And it's designed really to give some helpful tips and advice to young people who are at school or college and wondering, how do I handle the topic of evolution when it comes up? You're a Christian young person, perhaps, at school. Evolution is being taught in your biology class. What do you do? Do you argue with your teacher? Do you try to opt out of science and go and study something else instead? How do you respond? This booklet is designed just to give you and your families some helpful advice on what to do in those circumstances. So do have a look at the resources on our stand. And do sign up for our prayer news. We send out the prayer letter three times a year. The current one is just hot off the press. It just arrived from the printers this week. So there are copies available on the stand. And do sign up to receive that regularly so you can pray for the work in the future. Well, that's enough just by way of introduction to BCT. Let's dive into this topic, and I hope you've got your geological thinking caps on for this session this afternoon. We're going to be looking at geological evidence against the millions of years timescale. One of the major tenets of biblical creationism is the idea that the earth was supernaturally created by God in 6 days, about 6,000 years ago. Now, this young age position stands in stark contrast to the conventional old age position, which says that the earth was formed by purely naturalistic processes about 4.5 billion years ago. One of the problems that we face as biblical creationists is what we might call the plausibility problem. The plausibility problem. So ingrained is the old age view, not only in the scientific community, but also in the wider culture, that to challenge this view seems ridiculous to many thinking people. It simply doesn't seem credible to many people to suggest that geologists might have got the question of the Earth's age so wrong, or that the rock layers that geologists study might have been laid down in a short period of time rather than over millions of years. And so if we're to gain a hearing for biblical creationism, even among many of our fellow Christians and evangelicals, we need to address this plausibility problem. And in this talk, I want to suggest an approach to the question of the Earth's age that I think has some merit in helping us get over this plausibility barrier. Now, the focus of my talk is going to be the Earth's sedimentary rock record. It's the field of science that I know best, trained as a geologist. And the Earth's sedimentary rock record is regarded by many as the primary evidence for the millions of years timescale, for the long age model of Earth history. I want, in this talk, to present an extended argument, a kind of cumulative case, that the young age model, in fact, makes better sense of this sedimentary rock record than the old age model. Now, we know that the continents are covered with fossil-bearing sedimentary rock averaging about 1,500 to 2,000 metres thick, though much thicker in some places. We also know that these sedimentary rock layers were deposited as beds or layers or strata of usually water-deposited sediment like sand or clay or silt, that were subsequently subjected to further burial and compaction and cementation to transform them into sedimentary rocks. And the question we want to ask, the question we want to address, is how quickly were these sedimentary layers deposited? Were they laid down during a one-year flood and its aftermath, as we can infer from the Bible? Or were they laid down over a time span of hundreds of millions of years, as indicated by radiometric dating? Now, we need to say a word or two here about radiometric dating, because these are the dating techniques that are used to assign ages of millions or billions of years to the rocks and minerals that make up the Earth's crust. Radiometric dating uses naturally occurring radioactive isotopes as a kind of clock that can be applied usually not to sedimentary rocks but to igneous rocks, things such as lava flows and volcanic ash deposits, which we find interbedded or interlayered with the sedimentary rocks. And I think we have to acknowledge that radiometric dates have a kind of inherent plausibility at first glance. Firstly, for example, they give us actual numbers with error bars. If we go to Grand Canyon, as you see here, a number of these rock units, as you see, have been dated by various radioactive clocks. And a rock in the Grand Canyon can be assigned an age of 1,111 million years, plus or minus 81 million years. Okay, now the plus or minus, it sounds a lot, isn't it? 81 million years, but that's still a, you know, relatively small error bar when you're talking about timescales of billions of years. And the fact that you can put a number with an error bar on these radiometric dates lends them, I think, an air of apparent precision. Although precision, of course, is not the same as accuracy. What's more, radiometric dates generally reflect the relative ages of rock units established from other geological evidence. So, for example, here in the Grand Canyon, we have these various rock layers that have been dated by a particular radioisotope clock, and despite the variations and uncertainties in the dates, nevertheless, this clock indicates correctly the relative order in which these rock units must have formed. So radiometric dates have a kind of apparent plausibility about them. How can we challenge this problem of radiometric dating? How can we address this challenge and overcome the plausibility problem? Well, one approach is to challenge the assumptions that underlie radiometric dating. For example, we could question the initial conditions, or we could question the constancy of radioactive decay rates, or we could talk about the contamination of the samples that are being dated. And that approach has much merit to it. And that was the approach that was taken by the creation scientists who made up the RAPE group, whose research uncovered lots of evidence that radioactive decay rates were not constant in the past, but had been accelerated during the flood. And you can read more about that research in this book, Thousands Not Billions, by Dr. Don DeYoung. But there is another way to challenge radiometric dates, and that's to ask whether radiometric dates make sense when we compare the results of these methods to other kinds of geological information. And that's what I want to do in this talk. I want to begin by thinking about sediment accumulation rates. How quickly are sediments laid down today? Now, there are several methods that we can use to estimate the rates at which sediments are being laid down today in a whole variety of environments, from rivers to lakes to oceans. One method involves spreading a thin, easily identifiable layer of marker material, white clay, something like that, over a sediment surface. And then we come back at selected intervals to see how deeply that marker layer has become buried. Another common method is to use a sediment trap of some kind. A sediment that collects in the trap can be recovered, and we can estimate the rate at which sediment is being transported and deposited. Now, we know from these kinds of studies that modern sedimentation rates vary quite a bit depending on the particular environment in which the sediments are being laid down. But generally, sedimentation rates today range from less than 0.1 of a centimetre per year to more than 2 centimetres per year, most often averaging around 1 centimetre per year. Try and remember that number, 1 centimetre per year. That's the average sedimentation rate today. What about sedimentation rates in the geological past? How quickly were sediments laid down in the past? Well, we can't directly measure those rates, of course, because we weren't there. And so we have to rely on indirect methods to estimate sedimentation rates. And radiometric dating is one method that we can use to estimate ancient sedimentation rates. So in this example that you see here, we have a stack of sedimentary rocks, a column of sedimentary rock, and sandwiched In this sequence of sedimentary rocks, there are two volcanic ash layers. There's a volcanic ash layer at the top, which has a radiometric date of 545 million years, sorry, at the bottom, and then a volcanic ash layer at the top that has a radiometric date of 495 million years. Between the two ash layers, we can measure the thickness of the sedimentary rocks, and it's 500 metres of rock. So we can calculate, can't we, the time it took to deposit these sediments by subtracting the uppermost date from the lowermost date, which gives us 50 million years. So we have 500 metres of sediment deposited, according to radiometric dates, over a time span of 50 million years. That gives us an average sedimentation rate of about 0.01 metres in 1,000 years, or 0.001 centimetre per year. Now, as with studies of modern sedimentation rates, estimates of sedimentation rates based on radiometric dating vary quite a bit. But they typically range from less than 0.0001 centimetre per year to more than 0.01 centimetre per year, most often averaging around 0.001 centimetre per year. Now, that's lots of numbers, but if you've been paying attention so far, and I hope you have, hope you've followed so far, you'll have noticed something very striking. The average sedimentation rates that we've estimated using radiometric dates are much, much, much slower than the average sedimentation rates based on measurements that we can directly make in modern lakes, rivers, and oceans. In fact, ancient rates based on radiometric dating are slower than modern rates by three orders of magnitude on average. That's a 1,000-fold difference. That's a huge discrepancy. Another way of expressing this discrepancy is to say that if sedimentation rates in the past were similar to those in the present, which I think is the assumption that most long-age geologists would make, there ought to be many, many more times sedimentary rock than we actually see in the geological record. There's nowhere near enough sediment for a world that is hundreds of millions of years old. Now, long-age geologists are well aware of this discrepancy, and in fact, they have been for a very long time. Now, what I'm saying to you, in one sense, is nothing particularly new. In fact, one of the classic studies of this problem was by this geologist, Peter Sadler, currently at the University of California, Riverside. In 1981, Sadler compiled nearly 25,000 estimates of sedimentation rates over different time spans, ranging from modern measurements made in a single hour during a flash flood to estimates of ancient sedimentation rates over millions of years based on radiometric dating. And when he plotted these estimates on a graph, he found an orders of magnitude discrepancy between the estimates based on radiometric dates and those based on modern measurements. In fact, the discrepancy gets bigger the longer the time span over which you make the estimate. Now, this is known as the so-called Sadler effect. So there's a problem. What's the solution to this problem? Well, long-age geologists have come up with an answer. Their proposed solution is to say that much more sediment must originally have been deposited, but that most of it was eroded away before it could be preserved in the rock record. Or to put it another way, If the long age model is right, if the millions of years timescale is correct, the Earth's rock record must be the product of only brief episodes of sedimentation interspersed with very long periods of time when nothing was going on or erosion was taking place. And indeed, if you read the standard geological literature, this is exactly the view that you'll find expressed there. The late Professor Derek Ager, who was a very well-known British geologist, summed it up this way in his book, The Nature of the Stratigraphical Record. The capitals and the italics are his, by the way. He said, the sedimentary pile at any one place on the Earth's surface is nothing more than a tiny and fragmentary record of vast periods of Earth history. This may be called the phenomenon of the gap being more important than the record. You get that? The gap more important than the record. And in fact, he drove home this point in the same chapter by saying this. If you study textbooks or correlation charts, such as those produced by the geological societies, you come inevitably to the conclusion that the stratigraphical column in any one place is a long record of sedimentation with occasional gaps. But I maintain that a far more accurate picture of the stratigraphical record, the rock record, is of one long gap with only very occasional sedimentation. One long gap and only very occasional sedimentation. What these long-age geologists are proposing is that many successive episodes of sedimentation occurred, but between each episode of sedimentation, there was a long time gap when most of the sediment that was laid down gets eroded away and not preserved. And perhaps an illustration might just help us to understand this point. Imagine we have some sediments deposited, but then there's a very long time gap. And most of the sediments that were deposited during the time gap get eroded away. And then some more sediments get deposited. And then there's another very, very long time gap, and most of those sediments get worn away by erosion. Then some more sediments are deposited, and again, a long time gap, during which most of them are eroded away. And then more sediments deposited, and again, a long time gap, and most of them eroded away. What we end up with is a column of rock, sedimentary rock, that is absolutely chock full of very, very long time gaps. In fact, I've probably underestimated the true picture with the number of arrows indicating the time gaps that I've inserted here. Now, if this view of Earth history is correct, then the sedimentation rates based on radiometric dating, which appear to be so much slower than modern day rates, would only appear to be unrealistically slow because most of the sediment that was laid down during Earth history is now missing. Right? It's not there. And this is, we're not talking about small periods of time here. Another geologist, Van Andel, has emphasized how much time these gaps in the record must represent. He said, invariably, we find that the rock record requires only a small fraction, usually 1 to 10% of the available time. Even if we take account of all possible breaks in the sequence, the universality and especially the magnitude of the shortfall are startling. 1 to 10% of geological time represented by rocks. That's 90 to 99% of geological time is missing from the geological record. But note with you, and this is very important, that both the long time gaps and the missing sediment are entirely hypothetical. Radiometric dating requires long time gaps and a great deal of missing sediment. But these things are not supported by actual observational physical evidence. In fact, to the contrary, the physical evidence we have provides powerful evidence against long time gaps. You see, time gaps should leave evidence. If erosion had removed lots of sediment, we would expect to see physical evidence that significant amounts of erosion had taken place. And perhaps this illustration will help us to understand this point. It's not coming across terribly well here on the screen, but hopefully you can get the picture. In A, we have a series of flat-lying sedimentary layers laid down. But then there's a long time gap, and erosion takes place, and an erosional topography develops, carving into these sedimentary layers. But then deposition of sediments resumes, more sediments are laid down, the old erosion surface is buried. And then there's a second cycle of erosion and deposition, and what we end up with is a very complex pattern with evidence of erosion sandwiched in between the layers, deep channels and gullies and canyons forming where time had passed. But in fact, what we most commonly see when we actually look at the rock record is what we see in E at the bottom. Flat-lying, horizontally bedded, sedimentary rock layers without evidence of significant amounts of erosion, without evidence of dramatic erosional topographies. Let's look at a specific example. This photograph shows the contact, indicated by the white dashed line, between the underlying Moen Kopi formation and the overlying Shinarump conglomerate in Dinosaur National Monument in Utah. Now, this contact, indicated by the dashed line, has been described as an ancient erosion surface that represents a very considerable span of missing time. In fact, if we place these formations on a standard geological age chart, we can see that between the underlying Moen Kopi formation and the overlying Shinarump conglomerate, the whole of the middle Triassic and part of the upper Triassic are missing, indicated by the question marks. According to radiometric dating, the missing time here amounts to at least 10 million years and perhaps as much as 35 million years. But is it really possible that so much time passed between these two rock formations? Well, geologists Art Chadwick and Leonard Brand have examined the contact between these two rock formations at most of the outcrops in southern and central Utah and northern Arizona. And they report that across much of this area, the contact appears to be perfectly flat, without any evidence of significant erosion. In fact, in the lower left of this slide, you can see thin siltstone and mudstone layers, which are soft, easily erodible layers, that are just below the contact. And they can trace those thin layers for tens of kilometers. How is it possible that these fragile sedimentary layers just below the contact were able to survive at least 10 million years of erosion? And in some places, there are structures known as load casts. In the lower right of this slide, you can see the underside of the Shinarump conglomerate, the underside of the bed. And the underside of this bed is covered in these lumps, these sort of bulges, known as load casts. And they form when one sedimentary layer is deposited on top of another layer, which is still soft and water saturated. And the sedimentary layer above sinks into the underlying layer and forms these bulges on the underside of the bed. That tells us that the Moan Kopi formation was still soft and unconsolidated when the uppermost layer was laid down. All of these features provide evidence that only a short period of time had passed between deposition of the Moan Kopi and the Shinaran formations. These flat contacts that are considered to represent very long time gaps are known to geologists as paraconformities. And in a 1984 paper, paleontologist Norman Muir acknowledged what a mystery these paraconformities are. He said this: a puzzling characteristic of these major boundaries is the general lack of physical evidence of subaerial exposure. Traces of deep leaching, scour, channeling, residual gravels tend to be lacking, even when the underlying rocks are hard, cherty limestones. These boundaries are paraconformities that are identifiable only by paleontological, that is, fossil evidence. And in fact, these paraconformities are found across the world and are actually quite common in the geological record. Here's the Grand Canyon in Arizona. And here I've labelled with the arrows three time gaps in this Grand Canyon sequence, representing respectively from the top 6 million years, 14 million years, and 100 million years of missing time. Now we can think about average erosion rates today, and we can say, how much erosion would you expect in 6 million years, or in 100 million years? Well, in 6 million years, we'd expect 180 metres of erosion. In 100 million years, we'd expect 3,000 metres of erosion. Now, to put that into some kind of context, Grand Canyon itself is 1,600 metres deep. We would expect to see an erosional topography at that lowermost time gap twice the depth of Grand Canyon in 100 million years. But the contact is flat. From the perspective of the long age model, the scarcity of erosion at these contacts is remarkable. Here are two more examples. This is the valley of the Colorado River, viewed from a place called Dead Horse Point in Utah. The arrows point to time gaps of 10 million years and 20 million years duration, respectively. Again, we can think about modern erosion rates, and we'd expect 300 metres at the 10 million year gap, 600 metres of erosion at the 20 million year gap. The modern canyon here is 600 metres deep. But the layers are perfectly flat lying, one on top of another, like pancakes in a pile. Here's another example. This is northeastern Utah, near the town of Vernal. The Cretaceous Cedar Mountain Formation lies above the Arrow, the Jurassic Morrison Formation, from which many famous dinosaur skeletons have been recovered, is below the Arrow. At the Arrow, we have a 20 million year time gap. In fact, you can trace this particular time gap almost 600 kilometres into New Mexico, where the Cedar Mountain Formation is missing as well, and the time gap represents 40 million years. And then you can trace it for another 200 kilometres. Often these time gaps are extremely widespread. Here in a canyon in northern Texas, this is an extraordinary time gap. At the Arrow, a time gap of 200 million years is indicated. We have the Pliocene above the Arrow and the Triassic below. That means, if you know your geological time charts, the whole of the Jurassic, the Cretaceous, the Paleocene, the Eocene, the Oligocene, and the Miocene are missing. Whole periods of geological time missing. And yet, this is a flat contact. We'd expect 6,000 metres of erosion in a time gap of 200 million years. That's four times the depth of Grand Canyon. And these examples are not confined solely to North America. This is a time gap in the Oligocene sediments on the South Island of New Zealand. Here is a time gap of somewhere between 3 and 14 million years. And as with so many other examples, this flat gap is extremely widespread. It can be traced right across southern Australia, Papua New Guinea, the New Caledonian Basin, and up into the deep sea plateaus west of New Zealand. And finally, here's an example a bit closer to home. Some of you may have been here. This is the north face of Penyvan in the Brecon Beacons in South Wales. The arrow here points to a time gap of about 10 million years. The layer just below the contact is supposed to have been an exposed land surface, exposed to erosion on the land for 10 million years before it was buried by the layers above. But what process of erosion can produce a surface that is traceable, as this one is, for hundreds of square miles, so flat that geologists originally didn't even realise there was a time gap here? So far-reaching are the implications of this missing time problem that the Geological Society of London devoted its annual meeting, its annual William Smith meeting in 2012, to discussing this issue. The papers from the meeting were published in a special volume entitled Strata and Time, Probing the Gaps in Our Understanding in 2015. And in the introductory paper to this volume, the authors said this: "The existence of time gaps is clearly demonstrated by the consideration of sediment accumulation rates, but identifying and quantifying them in the field is far more difficult." That's a very telling statement, I think. What they're saying is that radiometric dating requires only occasional sedimentation interspersed with these very long time gaps, but trying to work out where those time gaps actually are in the record is far from straightforward. In fact, they refer to the time gaps as often cryptic. You know what the word cryptic means? It means hidden. They're often hidden. And I think we're justified in asking the question, why is it so hard to find evidence of these time gaps if the long age time scale is correct? But in fact, the missing sediment and the lack of erosion are not the only problems for the long age model. Another problem concerns the absence of animal traces. Let me explain. The long age model assumes, as we've said, that there were long time gaps between episodes of sedimentation. And in those time gaps, one of several things might happen. As we've already said, the layer might well be eroded away. But even if it's not being actively eroded away, other factors come into play. Imagine a freshly deposited layer of sediment on the seafloor. And imagine that it's now sitting there, exposed for a very long period of time, forming the sea bottom, the sea floor. What will happen to that layer? Well, very quickly, animals, marine animals, bottom-dwelling animals, will colonize that sediment surface. They burrow into the sediment to build their homes or to process the sediment for food. And these activities, by burrowing animals, mix up the sediment, they churn it up, and they destroy any internal structures that the sediment once had. Any sedimentary layering, any structures get destroyed by this sediment mixing by animals. And we call this sediment mixing by animals bioturbation. The oceans teem with animals that bioturbate sediments. They're drawn from a very wide variety of groups. Among them are clams and snails and other kinds of shellfish, shrimps and other arthropods, sea urchins and other kinds of echinoderms, many different kinds of worms. How quickly do these animals burrow into freshly deposited sediments? Well, we know that many of them burrow very rapidly indeed. Some can burrow distances of centimetres to tens of centimetres in only seconds to minutes. One very remarkable burrower is the West Indian beach clam. Now, this is a species found in very large numbers in the tidal zone of sandy beaches in the West Indies. It can burrow into the sand at rates of half a centimetre per second and bury itself completely in just a few seconds. In fact, this and other closely related species can burrow so quickly that they actually follow the surf line up and down the beach with the rising and falling of the tide, a distance sometimes up to 30 metres. And it doesn't take very long for these burrowing animals to completely churn up a layer of sediment to a depth of several centimetres or even tens of centimetres. When a sedimentary layer is completely churned up so that all of the structure is lost, we say it has been homogenised, this process of homogenisation. And experiments with deposit feeding animals, animals that process the sediment for food, in population densities of 10,000 animals per square metre, have been shown to completely homogenise a sedimentary layer to a depth of 10 centimetres in as little as 1 hour. Perhaps you wonder whether such a high population density is realistic. But some of these burrowing animals on the seafloor reach population densities of 40, 50, 60,000 animals per square metre. And in fact, homogenisation of sediments is rapid even when population numbers are much lower than this. Lugworms in densities of only 200 individuals per square metre can completely rework the sediment they live in to a depth of 10 centimetres in 100 days. Sea urchins in densities of about 40 animals per square metre can completely rework the sediment they live in to a depth of 5 centimetres in only 3 days. Shrimp in densities between 89 and 890 individuals per square metre can rework the sediment they live in to a depth of 12 centimetres in 15 and a half hours. So given how fast these burrowing animals are known to completely churn up sediments in the modern ocean, if the long-age geologists are right that occasional sediment episodes were interspersed with long time gaps, we would expect the complete homogenisation of sedimentary layers to be the norm when we look at the ancient sedimentary rock record. And in fact, this point was made by Richard Bromley in his textbook on trace fossils. Richard Bromley is a geologist who is an expert on the burrowing activities of animals. And in this quote, he says this: 100% bioturbation of the substrate, 100% churning up of the sediment, is the natural end product of the activity of the endobenthos, the burrowing animals that live on the seafloor. Failure to reach 100%, or failure of that state to be preserved in the rock record, are conditions that require explanation. Can you see what he's saying? The complete destruction of all sedimentary structures, including layering, should be the rule if the present is the key to the past, and if the long timescales are correct. And if we find sedimentary layers that are not completely homogenised, we need to ask why. Well, what do we actually see when we go and look at the rock record? Over the last decade or so, The two geologists that I mentioned earlier, Art Chadwick and Leonard Brand, have been conducting an in-depth survey of bioturbation in rock formations in Utah and western Colorado, which is an area of the USA where much of the geological record is extremely well exposed. They have carefully worked their way through many vertical sections of rock measuring thousands and thousands of meters in thickness and representing most of the rock record from the Cambrian, conventionally dated 540 million years ago, to the Eocene, conventionally dated 56 million years ago. They've gone through those sections of rock, examining centimeter by centimeter, layer by layer, looking for evidence of animal burrows. And this column that you see here, the vertical black lines, indicate the geological age of the various vertical sections of rock they studied, superimposed on a geological column. And you can see this scale that they used to indicate the amount of burrowing that they found in each of those layers, the intensity of bioturbation scale. If the rocks were covered up by scree or vegetation or otherwise inaccessible, they had to put a question mark. Otherwise, if they were able to examine the rocks, they could indicate whether the level of bioturbation was 1, 2, 3, or 4. 1 indicates that there was no burrowing, no bioturbation at all, or at least none that significantly disrupted layering, right through to 4, which is complete homogenization of the sediment, complete destruction of all the layering. What did they find? Well, this is the section that they studied looking at the Triassic Moen Kopi formation. We mentioned the Moen Kopi earlier. On the very far left, you can see the column of rock that they measured. There's a scale in meters. This was a 500 meter thick section of Triassic Moen Kopi rocks. And as they went through this section, they indicated the level of bioturbation in every single layer, every single bed in this formation. And to the right of the geological column, the rock column, you can see another set of columns where we have a question mark and then 1, 2, 3, and 4. And what you can see here is that although they found a couple of beds, a couple of layers that had some burrows, there were none that significantly disturbed the sedimentary layering. So every single layer, as you can see with the thick black line, is marked in column 1. No beds with significant amounts of burrowing. This particular section was about average for all the sections that they studied on the Colorado Plateau. This section is a 60 meter section through a Cretaceous rock formation called the Mancos Shale. Again, you can see the rock column, 60 meters of rock, and you can see the columns. Some of this section was inaccessible, so we couldn't see what was going on, but where they could look at the amount of bioturbation, you can see that most of the beds were also marked in column 1. There were a few layers that reached as high as 3 with significant disruption of layering, and a couple of beds which showed complete homogenization. But most of the beds, even in this section, were ranked level 1. No obvious bioturbation at all, or none to disrupt the layering. And this was the section that contained the greatest amount of burrowing of any section they studied. So here we have another huge conundrum for the Long Age model. We know that the modern oceans teem with living creatures that burrow into sediments to build their their homes to feed. We know that this is an enormously effective way of destroying sedimentary layering. In fact, it's almost impossible to imagine a layer of sediment surviving intact even for a few years, let alone millions of years. And yet most sedimentary rock layers show hardly any signs of disruption by burrowing animals. Even when the fossils of the animals are present in the rock layers themselves. So we know the animals were there. This absence of burrowing, this absence of bioturbation, explains why we look at the geological record and see an abundance of sedimentary rocks with well-preserved, very distinct layering. These layers have not been homogenized by burrowing animals. Their internal structures are well preserved. In fact, if sedimentary rocks have been deposited as slowly as the Long Age model indicates, sedimentologists who rely on studying the internal structures in rocks to do their job would have a very hard time doing their research. Because we'd expect the normal activity of burrowing animals would have completely erased all of the sedimentary structures that sedimentologists study. Instead, the distinct layering that we see, the preservation of layering in the record, is much easier to explain if the sedimentary rocks were formed rapidly, as the Young Age model indicates, because in that model they would have been laid down far too quickly for burrowing to take place, even if there were burrowing animals present. So let's try and sum up what we've said in this talk and draw one or two conclusions. Radiometric dates suggest that the Earth's sedimentary rock record accumulated over a vast time span, hundreds of millions of years. But if the radiometric dates are correct, there is not nearly enough sediment, assuming that depositional rates in the past were similar to those measured in the present. Most of the sediment we would expect to see is missing. This conundrum can only be resolved within the Long Age model by assuming that the rock record is the product of occasional bursts of sedimentation interspersed with long periods of erosion or inactivity. But many places show no physical evidence of the expected erosion, even where time gaps of millions of years or hundreds of millions of years are thought to separate consecutive rock formations. Also, long time gaps would have provided abundant opportunities for burrowing animals to destroy sedimentary layering. But a careful layer-by-layer, centimetre-by-centimetre survey of the rock record shows that the expected levels of bioturbation are not observed and that sedimentary layering is generally well preserved. And so I conclude from this that the standard Long Age model based on radiometric dates fails to explain the Earth's sedimentary rock record. By contrast, the Young Age model is able to explain the data quite well. In the Young Age model, most of the fossil-bearing sedimentary rocks of the Earth accumulated in a year-long catastrophe, Noah's flood, and its aftermath, not over a span of hundreds of millions of years. During the flood, sedimentation rates would have been very high, perhaps somewhat similar to the kinds of rates we measure today during flash floods. These kinds of sedimentation rates during the year of the flood and in the centuries afterward can explain the observed thickness of sedimentary rocks that we see, with no need to invoke time gaps except where there is definite evidence.
During the flood, deposition was mostly too rapid for burrowing animals to homogenize the sediments. Unlike in the present day, when complete churning up of sediments is the norm, burrows are found throughout the sedimentary record, but the amount of activity recorded by those burrows is most consistent with only short periods of time. And so I conclude from this that the young age model offers a plausible explanation for the Earth's sedimentary rock record and deserves serious consideration by thinking people, and in fact I commend it as superior in its explanatory value to the standard long age model. Thank you very much. Before we go for our break, can I just mention a couple of resources? I mentioned earlier Don DeYoung's book, Thousands Not Billions. I guess, I haven't checked, but I guess there are copies of that book out on the book tables. And if you want to read up about radiometric dates, then that's the book to read. One other book that I found very helpful is written by the two geologists I mentioned in my talk, Art Chadwick and Leonard Brand. It's a textbook. It's written at a university level. It's called Faith, Reason and Earth History. And much of the material that has been covered in this talk you'll find in chapter 18 of their textbook. And the good news is that if you follow the web link that I have there on the screen, it is freely available as a download. You can download the ebook for no charge. If you can't read that web link on the screen, do come and see me on the VCT stand. And one resource that I'd like to mention at the end of my talk is this DVD, Set in Stone. If you want to look at in more detail at some of the evidences for catastrophism and short timescales in the geology of the British Isles, then this DVD is a great resource, Set in Stone, and there are copies available on the VCT stand. We're going to have a half-hour break. John Mackay, I think, is on next at 4 o'clock. Teas and coffees are available. Do take an opportunity to look at the books, visit our stand, and try to be back here, please, at 5 to 4 so that we can start on time for the next session. Thank you very much.
Because someone has left the lights on their car on. This is Green Grand Cherokee Jeep, registration LY03LXX. Grand Cherokee Jeep. So if you get the honour of that vehicle, please go and say the light before we won't be leaving this evening.
Okay.